This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. The debate over guns and how to keep them away from terrorists roiled Washington this week. Representative Annie Custer joined House Democrats during their sit-in demanding action on gun control.
We have got to take a stand. We can be silent no longer. We need a vote on the floor of this House.
Senator Kelly Ayotte, meanwhile, joined a bipartisan group rolling out gun control legislation they see as a compromise.
This is a common sense, bipartisan proposal to ensure that terrorists cannot purchase firearms. No fly, no buy.
Lawmakers in Concord also weighed in on guns, with a dozen Democratic state reps staging a sit-in of their own in New Hampshire's House chamber.
It is a war zone, and there are practical, sensible solutions that we can promulgate as legislators nationally and in this state that will make it just a little less so.
And Republican Donald Trump tells the New Hampshire man who managed his campaign, "You're fired." Here's Corey Lewandowski speaking to CNN.
Somebody was said to me 18 months ago, you'll be managing the candidate through 37 state victories, 14 million votes, more votes than anyone in the history of the Republican Party. I'd say, is that possible? And look what he's been able to achieve, and I've been a small part of that. So I have no regrets at all.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, Dan Barrick, politics and policy editor here at NHPR, and John DeStace, a political reporter at WMUR. Good morning. After the mass shootings, we tend to see a revival of the gun debate. This time, it seems hotter. It's obviously election season, but you look at D.C., Senate filibuster last week, 26-hour House sit-in this week, Democrats jeering Speaker Ryan, Republicans turning off the feed to C-SPAN. How should what has happened and what will be happening be understood?
I think there's a lot of institutional frustration on both sides here. Public opinion data shows the majority of people are in favor of some sort of stricter gun control. There's tremendous amount of debate and variation about what that should be. And as you mentioned, there's just been a lot of activity on Capitol Hill, both in the Senate and the House. None of it thus far has really resulted in anything tangible. Yesterday we had a test vote in the Senate of this compromise, the Susan Collins compromise amendment on the no-fly terrorist watch list amendment, and this is the one that Kelly Ayotte is supporting as well. That got a majority of votes, but it did not get the 60 that you would need to block a filibuster. So it's not even clear anything's going to come out of that. And I think people are waiting to see what the next move is by House Democrats. They ended, as you mentioned, this 26-hour sit-in, filibuster, whatever you'd like to call it. And they say they have some more plans in the works for when Congress comes back on July 5th. So, we've been here before. We were here with Newtown and the Sandy Hook shooting. We were here with San Bernardino. It's very difficult to make any kind of progress because whenever politicians who favor gun control try to move it forward, those who oppose it say it's an abridgment of the Second Amendment. It denies people due process. And those sorts of arguments. So I'm not sure what's going to happen, but it certainly is a hot political issue right now.
But as far as House Democrats go, I mean, obviously Speaker Ryan called what they did a publicity stunt. Do the makeup of the House, even if you could get a bill there, reaching any agreement is unlikely. What do you think, John? Do you think this is election season?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say the political undercurrent it's not even an undercurrent. It's really right on top of it in terms of the House race. Annie Custer was on the House floor sitting in. She then sent out an email which was asking constituents and supporters to sign a petition. Some Republicans are saying, well, that was just a way to get voters on her rolls so that she could fundraise with them. She took some very pointed hits from the two top Republicans who want to run against her, Jim Lawrence and Jack Flanagan. And then, of course, on the Senate side, Kelly Ayotte is right in the middle of this. And as Dean was saying, she signed on to the compromise. But before she did that, in order – she had to vote for two opposing bills earlier in the week, which were diametrically opposed, in order to move them forward. They all failed. So she was saying it was sort of a practical approach. But, of course, she opened herself to criticism that she wants to have it both ways. I think when you're explaining procedure, why I did something, why I voted for two bills that are on opposite sides, that could be a problem.
Yeah. Well, yesterday's vote, Dean referred to, it fell eight votes shy. And to get into procedure, you know, it was on a motion to discard, not to add to a pending appropriation bill. Some Senate watchers who purport to be expert in the ways of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell say that presages further inaction rather than action.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the politics on this aren't going to let up. I thought that the statement Kelly Ayotte released post-vote was interesting. You know, she said, you know, we're going to continue to try to work for something. But she also seemed to emphasize how small her proposal actually is, that it would be applying to, you know, a very limited number of people on the no-fly and on the no-fly list.
Yeah, I mean, I think as John indicated, how you interpret Senator Ayotte's votes over the last week it will depend on your view of her as a politician. A generous interpretation, as John indicated, is that she's trying to break the logjam by supporting proposals that may be opposed or she may not believe in fully, but she feels that there needs to be a vehicle to have this discussion. A more cynical interpretation, which Democrats in New Hampshire have been hammering with her all week, is that it's an example of her, maneuvering in a political season to try and shift her longstanding Second Amendment views. But I think the Ayotte Hassan raise probably best encapsulates better probably than any other lens in the country this alignment we have now between, you know, news and events out in the world, the Orlando shooting, a passionate public debate, and a very competitive election season. I think, you know, Ayotte's obviously trying to position herself as above the fray and sort of a link in any kind of compromise. And I think any accomplishment within the Senate will really help her. Whatever happens in the larger body will shape a lot of how she ends up looking come Election Day.
Why don't we,
Josh, I was just going to say, we don't want to leave the governor out of this. The governor also released a statement and also conducted interviews where she said that she supported this Susan Collins compromise, but very reluctantly, and as the very least that the Senate could do, she was more in line with, of course, the Democratic bill, which was sponsored by Dianne Feinstein of California. And even Senator Shaheen, just as an aside, supported this compromise as well. So interpret it as you wish, but kind of everybody's on board. But I think what Dean said is correct, and what you said is that it still has a hurdle to 52 votes is not nearly enough to get it any further.
Well, why don't we hear from the kind of horse's mouth, as it were. First, let's take a listen to what Senator Ayotte said about the bill.
There's no doubt that we all share the goal with the horrific terrorist attacks in Orlando, that we have to do all that we can to defeat ISIS and radical Islamist terrorists. But this attack also did highlight the urgent need to address the terrorist loophole. And we are doing that today.
Okay, that was Senator Kelly Ayotte earlier this week. And, you know, she talks about an urgent need and a need to address the terrorist loophole. She often tries to turn this discussion into one as these measures are a way to fight ISIS. Why don't we hear what Governor Hassan had to say after yesterday she said this?
Well, it's the very least that we should be doing. And it's better than nothing, but it is not nearly enough, because what Senator Collins' bill would do is still allow known and suspected terrorists to go online and buy guns or to go to a gun show and buy guns. And so we know we need to expand background checks. I can continue to be very disappointed that Senator Ayotte voted against closing the loophole for known and suspected terrorists in December, and I'm very disappointed that she voted against expanding background checks, and I'll continue to call on her to do that.
So that was Governor Hassan yesterday responding to the Susan Collins legislation that Kelly Ayotte apparently helped draft, part of the bill that dealt with due process for people looking to challenge the government's ruling that they, you know, should be on the no-fly list and therefore couldn't buy a gun. So, you know, we're looking at claims for more action. I mean, is this, you know, what do you think we're going to see? Just Democrats piling on, Ayotte treading water?
Yeah, this is going to be a very hot political issue. As I mentioned earlier, the Democrats in the House, even though we suggested that the chamber under the current configuration is not likely to move anything, Democrats in the House say they have a kind of a plan of action for after the 4th of July recess. You know, we really are talking about small changes here in the grand scheme of gun control. And you know, I think in the end, like a lot of other the issues that we talk about, it's going to come down to the November election. I think Hillary Clinton is going to run as hard on gun control as any nominee has in recent presidential cycles. It has not been, despite a number of the tragedies, it has not been kind of a driving political force in our national electoral discourse, and I think it will be this time around. And the reality is the only way you're going to get significant changes, I know that Governor Hassan said she would support a semi-automatic weapons ban. The only way you're going to get that kind of stuff is if the Democrats get the presidency and they get control of the Senate in a way that can break a filibuster and then significantly close the margins at a minimum in the House. So I think we're going to be in kind of a sort of a politically, rhetorically supercharged environment, but the reality is we're going to be looking towards probably the next administration for any kind of major changes, if at all.
But just think for a minute. I mean, the core, you said the changes even being proposed are relatively small bore.
Yeah.
And I think you would find an overwhelming majority in both chambers and probably in the public that people on the no-fly list should be at least limited, if not banned, from buying weapons, whether there's a waiting period, whether there's an appeal process, who should pay their legal fees. I mean, those are on. But the fact that, you know, we're sitting here almost 2 weeks after Orlando and we're looking very unlikely that even that very small, probably consensus view is unlikely to get passed speaks to, you know, just the atmosphere within Washington right now and probably feeds a lot of the voter, you know, what we've been reporting on for the last 2 years about just voter disgust with Washington.
Speaks to the pure politics of it, Dan. And the other aspect of this, which got overshadowed by the terrorist, the no-fly, no-buy, was the background checks, which Senator Ayotte continues to be, you know, steadfast on while she's negotiating on the no-fly, no-buy. Background checks is a major issue, and she hasn't moved on that, and neither have the Democrats. So I think that regardless what happens with the no-fly, no-buy, the rhetoric that we – going forward is going to be circling back in the attacks on Ayotte with regard to the background checks.
But, I mean, obviously we have from Hillary Clinton on down Democrats seeing this as, you know, an issue that they can gain some political purchase on. You know, that hasn't always been the case in New Hampshire. You know, obviously, John, you've covered a lot of elections here. I mean, do you think there's any danger for Democrats locally on this issue in any races?
Well, I was a little surprised, to be honest with you, Josh, that, you know, the governor went that far. I mean, in terms of going left on this, considering where she, you know, where she is, where she lives. But obviously she's not out for the, you know, she does say that she wants to protect the Second Amendment and et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, she is sort of on the left when it comes to the background check situation in terms of supporting the more liberal bill on the terrorist watch list. So it depends on who turns out. And it goes back to what Dean said, who turns out on the election. And this year, with considering who's at the top of the ticket, that's really anyone's guess. Is it going to be sort of the Trump people? They're all going to turn out, but who's going to turn out more? And that will have a lot to do with the Senate race, I think, ultimately.
Well, and on the Republican side, obviously Kelly Ayotte has been under pressure for, you know, a number of years now based on votes that took place after the Newtown shooting regarding expanded background checks. And you're correct, John, that she hasn't indicated that she's likely to move on that. She's very much focused on, you know, the no-fly list. You know, is that sort of a line in the sand for, you know, Republicans seeking federal office at this point, do you think?
Background checks?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's – yeah, I think, again, that's one that is always going to be there, and that's one that seems to be immovable. While there may be some negotiation on the other issue, given the overwhelming concern about terrorism, this is one that's going to just continue, and I don't really see I don't know if anyone here does, but see negotiations taking place on the background checks. So I think, as we have already seen from the Gabby Giffords advertising against Ayotte, this is where the Democrats are going to continue to focus, regardless of what happens on the watch list and no-fly legislation.
And I think just even looking back, Ayotte's position on at various stages in this debate over the last few years is illustrative of the larger Republican approach. After Sandy Hook, her focus was largely on the reform needs to be around access, mental health issues and access of folks with mental health mental illness access to firearms. Now the focus is on terrorists and because of the link there to Orlando, rather than opening up a larger conversation around background checks and you know semi-automatic rifles and that kind of thing, but focusing on a narrow presumably because it's you're able to gather wider consensus, but also because I think it limits the larger debate over the larger issues that, as John indicated, are often no-go for Republicans.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I was thinking about something similar in terms of this being different from the previous discussion because we're not having Republicans kind of shift the focus from weapons to mental health. But you're right. It does – sort of the concept of terrorism and no-fly and a watch list kind of sort of aids the conservatives in the sense of kind of limiting the terrain of the that's debate. Right. And so it does feel a little bit different because we're not having that broader mental health conversation.
But one of the measures that was before the Senate This Week in Amendment sponsored by Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley sought to redefine the terms of mental illness. And, you know, I think that the debate over that raised questions about, you know, that's a sort of a can of worms that can become complicated. You know, he was doing it with the idea of making it easier to get guns out of the hands of people who had mental problems. You know, Democrats said that the language, you know, may have actually created problems in that regard. So, you know, mental health is fraught, but it's definitely true that we're not hearing much of that. And that was one thing. I did this week on Ayotte and guns through the years. I was listening back to tape of the daughter of the Newtown school principal confronting her at a town hall meeting. And what Senator Ayotte said to this young woman was, you know, we both know that background checks weren't really the issue here. The one thing I believe that we can work towards coming together on is mental health.
And I mean, there was – and nothing occurred from that. Nothing resulted from that.
Yeah, that was a great story that you did looking back on the way her position has evolved or, depending on your point of view, some might say devolved. But, you know, every election is different. She was certainly – out there on that issue as being, you know, didn't she just join the NRA around 2010 at the same time? I think the big picture, though, was very fascinating, just the intertwining of all these issues of guns and terrorism and immigration. And it's all part of the scene that's just fascinating this time, unlike, I think, anything we've seen in quite maybe ever.
All right. Just a reminder to listeners, you can join our scene on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup by calling 1-800-892-6477 or email us exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Josh Rogers, joined by John DeStace of WMUR, Dan Barrick, an editor here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. So I guess we're going to the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. We're looking at how races are shaping up in New Hampshire with considerable amounts of money being raised on both sides. As always, you can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have received an email from Ashley from Concord. She said that she just wanted to request that we weigh in on the power that the NRA, National Rifle Association, holds over our lawmakers, is big in Washington. How big do you think it here is in New Hampshire?
I think it's, you know, it's certainly a factor. But I don't see a lot of out front NRA presence. I know it's Vahir. I'm not in any way doubting that. But I think that it's certainly something that the candidates, especially on the Republican side, are well aware of.
Yeah, you know, you often hear that when we talk about these kinds of pushes for gun control in the U.S. Congress, the Senate and the House, that, you know, the NRA, you know, the critics will say that the NRA has these various members of Congress in their pocket and that, you know, they essentially threaten retribution if Republican candidates sort of vote against their interests. You know, it's certainly a very powerful lobby. I think, you know, probably the reality is a little more complicated than that. There are, you know, a host of other issues going on with, you know, ideological polarization in the electorate and in the House redistricting. But certainly the NRA is a powerful lobby group. And it is true, if you look at public opinion data, the data seems to suggest that people want some kind of reform. But that's at odds with the preferences of a number of the conservatives in Congress.
I mean, it is primary season before we get to the general election.
Right.
And
sure.
I think it certainly is true that within the context of a Republican primary, you know, people, voters who are conservative with the Second Amendment and affiliated organizational groups, you know, do have their say in state races.
Yeah, the gun owners of New Hampshire, I was just going to say, they are significant in the state of New Hampshire. And so we will see how pleased they are with Senator Ayotte on some of her issues. And, of course, Jim Rubens, who is running against Ayotte, to her right, is painting her as being, you know, just kind of wishy-washy on this and a number of other issues.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly an issue in which, you know, he could potentially gain some traction mm-hmm. and get a little attention. I know he was doing radio interviews this week where he was really going at her on this issue. But let's turn to some of the state races. You know, it is a national election year, so obviously people are going to be focusing at the very top of the ticket, and all politics do sort of become national in presidential years. But, you know, it's going to be quite busy lower and as well, and we've got new campaign finance numbers, and they suggest that some of the candidates are raising decent slugs of money,
especially on the governor's side. Two of the Democratic candidates, Colin Van Alstyne and Mark Connolly, released their figures. Oddly enough, they're not required by state law to do so. Only candidates are not required until August, which would be only a few weeks before the September primary. But both candidates took the step of releasing now in June, which is typically the time when sort of issue-oriented committees file. The numbers are pretty stark. Van Alstyne came out with a pretty large number, about $850,000 raised, and about half of that spent. His campaign is calling it the largest haul, first-term haul for a non-incumbent Democrat. Connolly's numbers were about half of that. He raised about $400,000, $100,000 of that a personal loan, and about half of that cash on hand. I mean, Van Alstyne had sort of been making noise for some weeks now that he was going to be releasing his numbers early as an effort of transparency. I think it's also, you know, sort of a shot across the bow.
Yeah.
And, you know, anyone who's been following politics for a while, been keeping an eye on this campaign in the background, would not necessarily be surprised by that. I mean, I think the number was higher than most people would have figured. But Van Alstyne has been working very hard, very strong connections to both the grassroots of the party and the power structure of the party, a very, you know, has run numerous campaigns, knows how to raise money, knows. And Connolly's numbers, I think, were respectable. The fact that he's also a man of means, of considerable wealth, and potentially will be able to and will be willing to loan his campaign more money or just spend it outright, is indicated in his filing. None of the Republicans filed their figures, so hard to say. But I do think this filing sort of does – it's the first sort of reshaping somewhat of assumptions and expectations of the Democratic
primary.
Well,
it's the time of year when we get lots of press releases where people claim you know, a record haul in this or that subcategory, and you're sometimes reduced to reporting in what so-and-so claims is a record. You know, certainly there were you know, PACs involving – you know, Senate, you know, affiliated PACs with the Republican and Democratic Party, which also released numbers this week, which suggests that, like, they're doing pretty well, too, and that the battle for the state Senate, which, you know, could be interesting, is going to be reasonably well-funded.
I agree. If I could just make one point on the governor's race, it's really this week was really the most attention that the Democratic side has gotten in what otherwise has been a really very quiet primary as compared to the Republican side, where there's been a fair amount of rhetoric going on back and forth, especially between the Gatsas and Sununu camps. As far as the state Senate goes, yes, both the Senate Democratic Caucus and the Republican Caucus, headed by Senate President Morris, have claimed records. The Republican pack has more on hand than it says it's ever had before, and the Democratic side has said that it's raised more than it's ever has before, and it's several hundred thousand dollars on each. And it's just amazing. If you go back years ago, it used to be very small funding numbers for state Senate races. But just like anything else, they have just ballooned in the past cycles, and it's very important. Democrats feel like they can win back control of the state Senate, very strongly about that, between the fundraising and also their grassroots effort. But, the Republicans have their strong bases of support in certain districts, and I just think it's really, like anything else, a toss-up. And going back to circle back what we said before, well, that will depend on what happens at the top of the ticket.
It's very interesting in the governor's race, as we're suggesting here, this really is kind of, on the Democratic side, certainly kind of the first real shaping of the race that we've seen. And I've noticed that there really has not been any clash between the candidates on the Democratic side in the way, as John mentioned, on the Republican side, there has been. So, you could say, Colin Van Ostern has this significant haul of cash. He's got $500,000 on hand, and he's clearly well-organized. That in some way makes him the front runner by traditional standards, but Connolly had a good fundraising haul as well. On the Republican side, I've had several people suggest to me that just by default, Sununu is the front runner because all the other candidates are attacking him, and to the extent that they are sort of swinging at him, that in some way kind of anoints him as the front runner. And I think it's still early, but it is interesting how much more contentious that race has been.
Well, how much do you think
that Democrats?
I mean, how much do you think that is emblematic of just the kind of internal cultures of both parties?
Well, it's an interesting question. Why one and not the other? Yeah.
Well, when is a Democratic primary in New Hampshire been really that nasty lately?
I think no. You'd have to go back. For me, I can't remember one since like the early 90s when Arnie Arneson emerged to become the nominee in a three-way primary. I would be remiss not to mention that one of the most aggressive, if not the most aggressive Republican in the Republican primary, though, has been Senator Jeanie Forrester. She's really probably had the harshest rhetoric for Sununu. She's not viewed as a again, it's all a matter of viewpoint. Sununu is the name recognition. Now, is that going to help him? Or, some would like us here in the media to compare him to Jeb Bush, that he may suffer the same fate.
Well, Senator Forrester,
because of the mood of the Republican electorate.
Well, I mean, she likes to tuck in the, he comes from a political dynasty.
Right. She's the one who's brought that up. Right.
I also think that Mayor Gatz has had an interesting, his press shop sent out a press release, documenting what they claim is a pattern on Chris Sununu of being non-responsive.
Yes.
Everyone's trying to get attention. We'll see where this goes. I mean, the polling definitely does indicate that, Sununu has a name recognition edge. How much that matters. Frank Edelblue, he's obviously seems to be doing pretty well among sort of core Republican activists.
But this question that you raised, Josh, of the difference in tone between the
culture,
two parties and culture,
cultures, yeah.
I think that's true. But I also think just on the issues, if you look at the Democrats, Connolly, Van Ostern, and Marchand, very little difference in either the issues they want to talk about, Medicaid expansion, continuing that, expanded rail, full day kindergarten to a certain extent, they're pretty much all on the same page. Whereas on the Republican side, there are differences on all those issues between the candidates. One interesting thing I noted this week, as John indicated, the three Democratic candidates met for a forum, sort of their first, I think since the convention last week. One area where you saw Steve Marchand, who's probably the candidate who's been least, sort of the least active, tried to distinguish himself as, in his words, as the most progressive candidate, is focusing on repealing the death penalty and legalizing marijuana, which are two issues of, sort of, especially the death penalty, really for core liberals in the state, very important. So, I mean, that's one area where you've seen sort of a policy distinction. But other than that, I think it's mostly a question of name recognition and just hustle that's occupying the Democrats right now.
I call it the Bernie Sanders effect on the Democratic side. I mean, everyone's trying to move to the left, and Steve used to be Concord Coalition.
No labels.
Right down the middle, you know, Joe Lieberman and John Huntsman and Steve Marchand was right there. And now, you know, he's moving left. So I just think it's fascinating. And I think it has a lot to do with people seeing the results of the presidential primary on the Democratic side.
Can I just go back real quickly to the some of the fundraising numbers, particularly around the Senate and House PACs? I think, as John indicated, you know, lots of numbers there, pretty big numbers, especially from the Democrats. But one thing that struck me was just the amount of spending going on, especially on the Democratic side. I mean, I think the Senate Democrats, they raised about $375,000 and have just $160,000 on hand. So they've spent over $200,000 and we're in June, whereas the Senate Republicans raised about $275,000 and spent only about $20,000. Now, obviously, you know, and we've seen that in the past. It's a much more aggressive spending on the Democratic side within those committees. And I don't, it just stuck out to me as notable, and whether that's going to presage further high raising, high spending, or if they're, it's hard to know where that's.
They try to staff every Senate race. I think, I don't know if they have one staff for each Senate race, but I think a lot of the spending that you're seeing is on staff getting ready for, you know, the coming months.
Each of the 24.
Well, and some of the Senate races are not being contested, which was interesting, and certainly one of the things that, you know, often can be telling in election years is which party manages to get more people signed up to run. And that's one thing Democrats are pointing to as well, is that they have a 25 seat registration edge in the House, which often, you know, can be predictive.
Yeah, I mean, we've had this discussion for a number of years that there are sort of differences in kind of the level of sort of organization and infrastructure between the two parties in the state. And, you know, I think in the Democrats, I think the chair is a paid position. Is that correct? And the Republicans, yeah. It's not. They're just – I just recall having this discussion for many election cycles about, you know, Democrats are kind of more organized, more money, more infrastructure. Republicans, it's a little more ad hoc and not quite as focused. And, you know, maybe you're seeing a little bit of this time around as well.
Yeah, I think you see that just about in all recent elections. You just see a result of the organization, and it's just a complete reversal than it was some time ago.
It used to be, yeah.
And the money aside, I mean, the Republicans still do enjoy pretty strong structural advantages just within the drawing of the district lines,
right,
especially in the Senate. Some of that may change, especially some of the so-called swing districts that are now held by Republicans. Jerry Little's district, District 8, Nancy Stiles' District 24, David Booten's district even, where you've got incumbent Republicans leaving the Senate, open races in districts that could go either way. That may shift. But Republicans have controlled the redistricting process in New Hampshire for decades. And that has an effect. That has an effect even in a year like this, where you may see a wave election, or you may see, you know, turmoil at the top of the ticket that will filter its way down. So, you know, that's a factor too that transcends the money question.
Well, you know, speaking of money and politics, you know, Congressman Frank Ginta is facing sort of fresh scrutiny for campaign finance issues. You know, specifically, what's going on there, John?
Well, I don't want to take up the rest of the show with this, but basically, Fergus Cullen, the former state Republican Party chairman, who's no fan of Frank Ginta and hasn't been for some time, filed an FEC complaint where he basically said that when Frank Ginta borrowed received the $355,000 from his family account, that is being his parents, he began to pay it back by paying himself back $81,500. Then he separately paid back all $355,000 to the Ginta family account, but he never gave the $81,500 back to the campaign to pay the $355,000. Therefore, Cullen is saying that he paid himself twice, and that's a violation of federal election law. Again, scrutiny. Again, it's a complaint that's been filed. It did draw attention in the media, as a lot of these do. It could take years again to resolve this. But it will be a topic of discussion, certainly, in the first district. We'll see if Rich Ashew, his Republican opponent, brings this up or just kind of lets it float out there as another example of what they will consider to be problems by Frank Ginta. Just one footnote is there is a PAC which is actually supporting Ashew, And so Ashley really doesn't have to say anything. I think this PAC, which is headed by Matt Maurer, the former executive director of the State Republican Party and Chris Christie guy, I think they're going to be out there reminding voters. They've already said, and I wrote this little brief thing in my column about they're going to send letters to donors of Ginta with copies of the news stories on this issue and ask and provide them with contact information just in case they want to call Frank and ask him to refund the money.
Even if nothing comes of it in terms of actual legal aspects, and you're right, John, it could take a very long time, it kind of refreshens the argument about the whole campaign finance issue for Ginta going back to 2010. And, he's been trying to put that behind him, and now this kind of recycles it in a way. It was starting to get a little bit stale. It doesn't mean it goes away, but the issue was getting a little stale. It's been a little stale, and this is really very quickly freshened everything up.
I don't want to downplay. I mean, I don't want to say that Cullen's complaint is frivolous. Yeah. I think he makes a good point. I'm not an attorney, certainly, but when I read this and sort of followed the ball, I was like, okay, this is interesting. There is a question there, and we're going to get an answer, I understand, from Frank Ginta when he files his second quarter report. He says that that's going to all be taken care of by June 30th, and the filing has to come out by July 15th. And in that filing, this 81.5 will be addressed. So we shall see.
And you think back a year ago when the FEC settlement was first released, it was just a little bit over a year ago, the position Frank Ginta was in, where every top Republican in the state was either calling for him to resign or basically leaving him hanging. He had no defenders. And it's a year later, and he's campaigning. He's campaigning seriously. He's still raising money, not at the level he would probably like. He's in a primary against a very serious candidate. But he's not being written off. He's not being he's not a political afterthought. He's this is still an open contested primary. Issues like this, whether it's Fergus Collins, renewal, PACs, will keep this financial issue in the air around Ginta. But I do think, just from sheer political chops, you have to give the guy credit for Absolutely. What the last 12 months of his life have been like. And he's still out on the hustings.
Frank has his defenders, and he's keeping his nose to the grindstone. He has his defenders on the right and the Republican side. I'm just saying he's working. He's doing things that he's just looking blinders on, trying to keep his nose to the grindstone and do his work.
All right. Coming up, Gordon Humphrey rides again into presidential politics. This is Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. We're catching up on some of the top political headlines in the Grand State. As always, you can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@NHPR or find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're joined by John DeStaso, WMUR, Dan Barrick from NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. Let's turn to presidential politics for a minute and Donald Trump. Trump defenestrated Wyndham resident Corey Lewandowski, his campaign manager this week. How much of a surprise was that to you, John?
Well, it was quite a surprise that it just happened that, I read like everyone else that there was turmoil. Corey doesn't do a lot of contact with the local media anymore, but from what I understand, of course, there was turmoil in the upper echelon of the Trump campaign, and you've all seen the national reports on that. So, but still, at the same time, just the utter abruptness of it, I think, caught a lot of people by surprise. And I just think it's fascinating that just a couple of days later, he signed on with CNN as a contributor. The other point that just struck me, and maybe it's just totally unrelated, but it just is very interesting that 3 days after Corey was fired, Donald Trump canceled his trip back to New Hampshire, which he was going to do next Wednesday for the fundraisers that he did not hold when he was here the day after the Orlando shooting.
That was with Bill Binney, too.
That was with Bill Binney. And the interesting part of it is that, you know, well, I'm just going to watch to see if this portends anything. I mean, Cory is New Hampshire. He does love New Hampshire. And I just think that we'll see just locally, if I can speak parochially, to what degree Cory's absence might have an effect on the attention paid to New Hampshire by the Trump campaign.
Well, you know, I think this was really precipitated by this FEC report that came out showing that at the end of May, the Trump campaign had $1.3 million cash on hand, which is less than Annie Custer has and less than many members of members of Congress running for reelection have. And I think there was a sense of panic. And, you know, also in that report, we learned that, you know, their Trump campaign is mainly spending money on, you know, venues for these rallies and, you know, airplane flights. And not only that, he's basically paying his own companies for the use of these venues and the airplane, something like $6 million so far in the campaign. You know, we also learned, you know, Clinton campaign raising 10 times what he's raising in that period. So there's a real sense that they kind of needed to get their act together. There was clearly a lot of infighting between him and Paul Manafort, who's this other veteran, very veteran political operative who was brought in. I think there was a sudden realization that there's no campaign infrastructure there of the sort you would expect to see. And, you know, to some extent, that's a function of Donald Trump, who believes doesn't really need that he can kind of control the news cycle, and that's really worked for him in the primaries. So this is going to be a real good test of what you really need to run a general election campaign. And so, you know, they are very quickly now saying, look, you know, we got on the web and we quickly raised several million dollars, but they have a lot of ground to make up. So I think Lewandowski was just part of that. And interestingly enough, John mentioned he signed on with CNN almost immediately. Apparently he won't confirm it, but Trump has people sign non-disclosure agreements. So there's now some, which is unusual for a campaign. So there's now some controversy about, you know, how can the guy be a commentator if he has a non-disclosure agreement with the Trump campaign? So we'll see how that plays out.
And just to point out, Cory has continued to, you know, carry the flag, the Trump flag, and very, very strongly in the interviews that he has done with CNN. Since he's been fired, he hasn't certainly hasn't criticized Mr. Trump at all.
He said he had not a single second of regret, and that, right. I think is a direct quote. You know, Donald Trump winning is good for Cory Lewandowski. But you know, one thing that has been conspicuous back here in New Hampshire, sitting at my desk, is that in the post Lewandowski era, the Trump campaign has really been pumping out the press releases. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been getting paper statements on this
rapid
and that,
response.
And so it's less the candidate himself on Twitter, and that was, you know, one of the criticism based on others' reporting is that, you know, the sort of anti Lewandowski folks within the Trump orbit said that, you know, they at least accused Lewandowski of sort of playing into what they considered bad general election instincts on Trump's part.
Well, you also see both in campaigns and in presidential administrations what they call the gatekeeper phenomenon, where somebody in a very powerful position with physical access to the candidate will sort of block other sources of information and conflicting advice of getting to the candidate or the president. And it sounds like he was kind, you know, he flew everywhere with the presidential candidate. He was sort of with him on his plane. And there's a sense that, you know, he was blocking sort of alternative messaging and advice from others. And we haven't mentioned yet the role of Donald Trump's family. Seems to be very involved in this as well in terms of advising him.
And, you know, Lewandowski's departure for the Trump campaign is obviously a national story, but locally, I mean, if nothing else, it brings to the end what for, you know, New Hampshire political watchers has been probably the most unlikely political trajectory of a New Hampshire political person over the last, I don't know how long. I mean, you know, Lewandowski was always described in the press as a New Hampshire political operative, but he was nobody's idea of an insider or some even a power broker, you know, worked for, you know, Americans for Prosperity here, some other smaller special interest groups. But, you know, the notion that he had risen from, served as a Marine patrol officer, a very unlikely career path to get to really, you know, where he's been for the last 6 months. So the heights of American politics.
And whether or not this is attributable in any way to him or not, a remarkable string of victories that, you know, no one was predicting. So we'll see how he does on CNN. But to turn to another you know, person who's had a sort of an unlikely trajectory through New Hampshire politics, former U.S. Senator Gordon Humphrey. He's sort of back on the scene and on the march, saying that he's going to make the case to delegates at the Republican National Convention that they ought to rethink supporting Donald Trump. Why don't we take a listen to what Senator Humphrey said to NHPR this week?
Well, I've got to believe a lot of Trump supporters are having second thoughts. I hope so. I think he's a dangerous man. I think he says some ugly things, has obviously some ugly thoughts about race and ethnic issues, women, gender. He's impetuous. He's a bully. And he's just not qualified to be president. I'm not going to support him. I have a responsibility to the nation and to the people and to my family to choose someone who is well fitted for the role.
All right. That was former U.S. Senator Gordon Humphrey talking to NHPR about his ongoing efforts to dissuade delegates from supporting Donald Trump at the Republican convention. Obviously, you've spent a lot of time around Gordon Humphrey through the years, John. What do you make of this?
Well, I think it's – I mean, again, he hasn't changed a bit. I think Gordon has always been one to say exactly how he feels, and it's interesting because that's what Trump says that Trump does. So we will see. I don't think that Gordon Humphrey is the only delegate in New Hampshire who feels this way. I understand that there are several who have said that they're not going to go. And we know that Judd Gregg has said that some time ago. There are a few others who are not going to go to the convention, and they're going to fill in with the alternates. And I think that just nationally, you also see this continuing. It's not as strong as it was prior to Trump wrapping up the nomination, or supposedly wrapping up the nomination, but with every passing week and Trump saying something more and more controversial, I think this will continue to be an undercurrent. Going back to what the Lewandowski exit, will Trump tone down now that Corey's out? You know, it all kind of ties together and it remains to be seen over the next month leading to the convention.
Well, and speaking of delegates, I mean, it's my understanding that Corey Lewandowski is intending to remain the head of the New Hampshire's delegation at the convention.
They still have the majority of the delegation, and Corey is going to be the chairman, and he's made that clear.
Well, what Humphrey's talking about here is getting involved in this movement at the convention. In the Rules Committee, the so-called conscience clause, there are a number of delegates who are trying to one of whom I think the one who is heading the movement up is on the actual Rules Committee. And the idea is to have the rules changed so that delegates will be essentially unbound and be able to vote their conscience if they decide they can't support him. I think that the latest count I saw was something like 400 delegates were interested in this. Very difficult to do, to change something on the Rules Committee. You have to go through – it's a big Rules Committee. It's over like 150 people or 160 people. And then you got to go to the convention. So it's not an easy thing to do, but it sounds like he is going to sort of get involved in that particular effort at the convention.
Well, and it's my understanding that he's going to be sort of trying to reach out to people within the New England region.
But which was incidentally one of the areas where Donald Trump did the best, New Hampshire, Massachusetts – Maine. I mean, those are some of his higher performing states.
Yeah. And if somebody – I mean, I don't know. It struck me as interesting that if, in fact, you know, Gordon Humphrey is going to be making the case to these Republicans who you might view as sort of, you know, kind of some sort of vestigial sort of Yankee Republican. I mean, in some ways it's sort of a, you know, kind of a strange messenger for that. But, you know, anyone in a pinch,
well, yeah,
I guess.
Of all people to be doing this, I think Mr. Outsider, again, is Gordon Humphrey. But he's so, you know, he's outside the outsiders now that he's kind of inside. What can you say? It doesn't surprise me that Gordon doesn't, you know, particularly take to Donald Trump, because Gordon Humphrey has always been someone who just has that, you know, principle. No wavering on the issues with Gordon Humphrey. The thing that did surprise me a little bit is he went with Kasich. Whereas instead of someone who is far more to the right, which I believe that Gordon still is a staunch conservative.
Well, what's interesting, I mean, I talked to him about this and he said that, you know, he sort of respects Kasich. Obviously, in the prior presidential election, he was a big Rick Perry supporter and, you know, obviously been a huge fan of Ronald Reagan. But
right.
I guess it will be interesting to see where this goes. I mean, he says he's going to be taking the fight, you know. But do you think it does seem that there's a sort of a fresh bump in kind of like anti-Trump churn on the Republican scene here and nationally that, you know, it seemed to be dying down. It seems to be coming back.
Much of that generated by the Trump campaign. I mean, generated by his comments on Judge Curiel, his response to the Orlando massacre, the fundraising results. I mean, there's new fodder. And again, much of it self-inflicted on the part of Donald Trump.
It seems like just when Republican elites are sort of getting either resigned or comfortable, whichever word you prefer, there's sort of a fresh round of this stuff. And the problem for Trump is the lack of consistency is going to make it increasingly difficult for people he needs to get behind him because, you know, people put their neck out and, you know, whether it's Paul Ryan or somebody else who says, OK, I'm behind this guy. And then all kinds of stuff happens, and then they have to kind of retract it and then go forward. And it's just very problematic for nailing down the kind of support you need for a general election campaign. So you've really got to be more consistent.
So just to bring this back locally, you know, John, you mentioned earlier that you saw some of the positions taken by Steve Marchand at this at the convention and this debate, you know, marijuana legalization
death penalty repeal.
That is emblematic of a Bernie Sanders effect. I mean, I've been trying to divine whether there's any kind of Trump effect going on in any state elections. I mean, do you folks see any sign of that?
I think in terms of – well, the Democrats continue to try to tie Kelly Ayotte to Trump, as we know, and the candidates for governor. I don't – it may be happening on the state Senate level, but it's more under the radar. Again, it will. The thing that will be interesting to me will be ultimately on Election Day, the Trump people turning out. You know, the Trump supporters. Will they then go down the ticket and vote for these other candidates who are more in the sort of the mainstream, more in the establishment?
In the governor's race in the Republican primary, it's been this. I mean, lukewarm is maybe the most generous description of the four candidates' response to Donald Trump. They'll respond when asked. They'll say, you know, that they support him. Some will say that they would campaign with him, but there's no embrace of him or his message or invocation of his name unprompted in that race, as far as I can tell.
And it's interesting, you know, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have very high unfavorability ratings, north of 50-60%. I think Trump may even be a little bit higher. Yet, the impact he's having on the Republican primaries here in the state, in which people are kind of either distancing themselves or having scheduling conflicts or what have you. On the Democratic side, even though Bernie Sanders won quite handily, you're seeing kind of Democratic politicians, whether it's Maggie Hassan or Jean Shaheen or others, kind of line up pretty comfortably behind Hillary Clinton, even though she lost the primary here by a significant vote. It just seems to be a lot more comfort with her as a known entity than there is with Trump on the Republican side.
Exactly. You know, the Bernie Sanders people, especially the leadership, they had to go through, you know, they had to go through their kind of withdrawal on this. And they made some points at the convention last week. They got the votes that they wanted taken, the votes lost, but they wanted a Democratic with a small D convention, and they got that. And so the leadership of the Bernie Sanders campaign in New Hampshire is, you know, falling in line behind Hillary Clinton. What I'm wondering is just the rank and file voters, are they going to stay home? How excited are those young people who were really fired up about Bernie going to be about Hillary? Is Trump himself enough of a unifying factor to give our four electoral votes to Hillary Clinton?
Dean mentioned the falling in line, or at least the embrace of Hillary Clinton that you're seeing up and down the ticket, which I agree with. But I do think you are hearing the impact of sort of Sanders rhetoric, which is also just classic liberal Democratic rhetoric, in ways that you haven't in the past. So you have on the Democratic gubernatorial primary Van Ostern saying he wants a New Hampshire that's in which not just the 1%, top 1% succeed, but all can succeed. You have Mark Connelly talking about what he describes as structural inequities within the political system, within our financial regulation system. These are issues that Democrats have been talking about for a while, but you would not typically hear John Lynch or Maggie Hassan talking about that in the context of a campaign.
No, but certainly not talking about sort of things being rigged and stacked, and some of that, you know, flows from Elizabeth Warren as well. But you know, the idea that basically, you know, it's a bum deal.
Yeah, and there's, I think, a recognition that you at least need to kind of hit those tones at some point in your stump speech to engage the entire party.
And you go back, like I said, Sanders' win here so overwhelmingly is having an effect very much on the Democratic Party in New Hampshire, just as it is nationally.
All right, quickly, guys, what are you going to be paying attention to next week?
well, we want to see what happens, on the gun issue, where that's going to go. But the U.S. House is out of session until July 5th. There's always something, Josh, believe me, as we all know this year particularly.
True enough, John.
Well, you sort of touched on this earlier, but I feel like we're finally at a point where the gubernatorial races, and particularly the Democratic side, are starting to gel. The financial figures coming out, we're a week out of their convention. I think there's going to be a lot more action in the next week there.
Yeah, we're only a week away from the 4th of July. That's the kickoff of the summer campaign season. Everything is electoral politics now. Today at noon, if you're down at Market Day, stop into the Barley House. It's our latest Pints and Politics interview. This time, Republican candidate Jim Rubens is going to stop by.
All right. Thanks for joining us at Exchange, the production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Mikesell and Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music composed by Bob Lord. I'm Josh Rogers.